This is an ABC podcast.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
I recall many, many years ago catching a small commercial plane out of Maroochydore. Very, very quickly, straight after takeoff, we were hit by some pretty rough turbulence. We were getting bounced around a lot. And the person sitting beside me very calmly put away their book, folded up their table, and assumed the crash position and stayed there for the entire length of the flight to Sydney. And for the first time ever, I found myself nervous while flying because all I could think was, what do they know that I don't? My name is Nick Healy. I'm filling in for Rochelle this week and coming to you from Shepparton in the state's Goulburn Valley region. And by now, you've almost definitely seen the dramatic images and videos of the Alaskan Airlines plane, a Boeing 737 MAX 9. It's mid-air. It's still flying. It's got a giant chunk missing from the side of it after what's known as a door plug blew out. Now, no one was harmed. Plane made a successful emergency landing, but the entire series of those aircraft have been grounded in the US while the fault is being investigated. I imagine, though, that's some pretty cold comfort if you have a fear of flying and haven't been able to look at the TV or your own social media feeds for days without seeing some really terrifying vision. So this morning, you and I, we're going to talk about a fear of flying, what it does to the people who experience it, how can they overcome it, and what media and news coverage like this can actually do to you. And that means hearing from you. Is a fear of flying something you experienced? Have you managed to get past it? Have you dealt with it in some way? What did you do? And I guess, what's it been like for you seeing all of that video, all of those photos from Alaskan Airlines?
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Now, Lisa Miller, of course, one of the best-known faces and voices right across the ABC, an award-winning journo, TV host, and in addition to all of that, Lisa wrote a book, a memoir, that in part looked at how she developed and then overcame a fear of flying. Lisa, good morning to you.
Good morning, Nick.
I know you have told this story many, many times, so with apologies, talk to me about how this fear of flying came about.
Oh, I never get bored talking about it because the response from people is absolutely immediate. So many people out there have, if not a full-on developed fear, something of an anxiety about fear of flying. And if I can help anyone, then I will keep talking about this until the cows come in, right? So picture this. I'm a young reporter. I'm in North Queensland. I'm based in Townsville for the ABC. We're asked by the 7:30 program to charter a plane and duck down to a mine to film something for the day and then scoot back to Townsville to be able to get it back out on air that night. Now, when you're in a rush like that, you're having to keep an eye on the weather, but, you know, you're balancing up. Do we go? Do we not? We got down to the mine okay, but then on the trip back to Townsville in this six-seater, there was a lot of storm activity. And so the pilot was diverting around these different storm cells. I was in the back of the plane with my headphones on, looking at the material that we had been filming that day, and all of a sudden I could feel the propeller start to slow. And I looked up with a fright, like I felt like the plane had dropped, but it might just have hit a bit of turbulence at that minute anyway. But the reality was one of the propellers on this twin prop was slowing and it appeared to stop. And there was kind of this scramble in the cockpit, the pilot clearly, you know, doing what he could do. Before we knew it, I don't know whether it was 10 seconds, whether it was 30, whether it was a minute, we're flying again. When we land in Townsville, the pilot sort of says, oh, sorry about that up there. And we wander off. And I find out later that because he was having to fly so much further than he'd anticipated around all these storm cells, that he was using more fuel and therefore he wanted to completely drain the main tank before he flipped over to the reserve tank. But when he flipped over to the reserve tank, there was an airlock. This is how it was explained to me. There will be pilots out there who'll be going, oh, that doesn't sound right or whatever. Doesn't really matter. What matters is what happened after that. And as a young reporter in Townsville, I kept having to get on charter planes. And each time I did, I became just a little bit more anxious about it. And then within a year, I had got to the point where jumping on a 737 from Brisbane to Sydney would involve at least 3 days prior of irritation, vomiting, anger that I was having to fly. And then it built into complete and utter certainty that I was going to die. I knew every flight I took, that was going to be my last, to the point that I would sometimes take a photo of myself before getting on the plane. So they had a new photo to run when they had the death notices of who had died on the plane.
So this
went on for some time. And in my book, I confessed for the first time that I had been approached to become the Moscow correspondent for the ABC. And all I could think of was, I can't fly Aeroflot. I cannot do that. Even though my dream since I was 7 years old was to be a foreign correspondent. The ABC never knew that. The ABC never knew that I had turned down this gig because of my fear of flying. And then on a trip to Tasmania, my then husband and I were there for a wedding, and I spent the whole week angry and upset that my friends had forced me to fly somewhere for their wedding. And I started looking at the ferry times on the Spirit of Tassie so I could hire a car, get on the boat, and then drive from Melbourne to Brisbane to get home again because I wasn't going to get on a plane. And my then husband said, this cannot go on. And that was the moment that everything changed.
Because we're talking about you going from a very rational kind of response to what happened to you, thinking, oh, I'm a bit nervous about flying next time, to something that was, as you describe it, genuinely debilitating, making the most incredible impact into your life and your future.
Oh, massive impact. And here's the other irony of it, is that I grew up with a family that had a little Piper Cherokee. Dad had a plane. We lived in the bush. We had our own airstrip. We used it more than we used the car. We'd go, hey, let's go pick up Grandma in Brisbane for the weekend. We'd jump in this four-seater and zip down there and pick her up. So my family, and especially my dad, who had this massive love of flying, they just felt so gutted for me. They felt sad and they couldn't understand how I had gone so far in the other direction.
So you found yourself in this situation. You're talking to loved ones. They're saying something needs to change here. This is not good for you. What did you start doing at that point?
Well, I signed up for a fear of flying course, and that was absolutely the best thing I could ever have done. And I was also told at the time that I had spent years, and we're talking now 6, 7 years, creating this fear inside me, because you are the one that is feeding it, right? Mm. And you feed it in ways that you and I will talk about and your listeners will understand, by consuming all the news stories and knowing what bolt's fallen out of a Hawaiian Airlines plane, or knowing that it was ValueJet that put a DC-9 into the Everglades in Florida. I was like Rain Man. I knew every single crash that had happened in the world, and I was convinced that my plane was going to be the next one to go down. So someone at this course said to me, the psychologist who was running it, they said, you have spent years working on building up this fear. It's now going to take time and effort for you to get rid of it. It's not going to happen overnight, and you actually have to do homework. You have to do the work. And so I knew that my dream of being a foreign correspondent was just going to completely disappear if I did not get on top of it. And it took, from the time I did the course to the time I remember getting on a plane and thinking, I'm so happy to be on this plane, was about 2 years.
What was the first step? What is day one of a course like this look like?
Well, for me, it was understanding the mechanics of why it's highly unlikely that a plane is going to crash. I mean, really, it's not a rational fear to think that you're going to die in a plane crash. It is so safe. And now I look up at the skies and I look at planes flying overhead and I think, I wish I was on that plane. The joy of flight is just so magnificent.
It is, to me, a weird... We know that planes crash. We hear these stories.
Not many of them.
Not many of them, I know. So it is like a fear that is on some level built in a reality. But as you point out, when you actually break it down, when you actually look at how many planes don't crash, that's when we start talking about the irrationality of
it. Yeah, it's not really built in reality, Nick, because what happens is because it's so rare and it's such a big deal when it happens, it then gets saturation news coverage. And so if you do have some kind of anxiety, and a fear of flying does not sit by itself. You know, there's been a lot of studies and work done on what it actually means to have a fear of flying. So back in the day when I did my fear of flying course, it was like, let's deal with the fear of flying. You could sit in the cockpit still. It was just before September 11. I'd get on the plane. My boarding pass would have a little FF, which did not mean frequent flyer. It meant fearful flyer. And they would immediately ask you, do you want to sit in the cockpit or do you want to sit in your seat? And I'd go, no brainer. I've got to sit in the cockpit because I need to go through the log books and check the maintenance of this plane. And the pilots must have just thought, here's another cookie one. Yeah, we've got her on board. But it's also, I think, to do with control, because I needed to feel that I was in control. And if you're sitting at the back of the plane relying on incredibly talented professional people in the cockpit, you still want to feel like you've got some sense of control.
Did it take the full 2 years for you to feel comfortable flying again?
I got my posting to America and I remember my poor producer in the DC office for the ABC. She had a list of airlines that Lisa would fly. And if she tried to book me on other airlines, like one day there was AirTran she'd booked me on, and I said, no, no, Janet, AirTran is actually what ValueJet became after ValueJet crashed into the Everglades, and AirTran is still hit and miss. I'm not sure about that, and eventually it got built by Southwest, but I quite liked Southwest because they only flew 737s, so I thought this is a good thing because those pilots are doing milk runs every day, and those 737s get all the right maintenance because it's one kind of plane. This is how my brain, it's exhausting to have a fear. This is the other thing. It is utterly exhausting. And, you know, anyway, I got there. I got there and I've now gone to the absolute other extreme. I wished I'd learned how to fly.
You still have time.
I got a lot going on in my life, Nick, just quietly.
Oh, yeah, I'm aware. No, I love the fact that you say you were the Rain Man of flights. You understood it. You looked into it. You used that knowledge initially, I think, weaponized against yourself by the sound of it, but later on to help you move through it. I have a beautiful text in saying, my husband cured his fear of flying by sitting beside the pilot in a small prop plane. Pilot talked him through everything. They could look at the pressure drops, see the storms. He understood at the end of it. And this text is saying he came out of it feeling like he understood and was a little bit cured of it. And a similar experience for you, I guess, spending that time in those cockpits.
Oh, I had a funny experience flying into Melbourne recently. It was super windy and we were coming in to land and I could see the woman next to me was a bit anxious, like she was gripping the sides of the seats. And I thought, oh, you poor woman, you've been there. But anyway, we're going to be on the ground soon. And of course, sure enough, we don't touch down and we swoop up and we do a go around because for whatever reason, the tears start coming down her face. And I said, oh, please don't worry. You know, there might have just been some unexpected gusts on the runway at that point. Another plane mightn't have exited the runway. Look, very shortly you're going to hear the pilot explain what happened. We're just going to go around and we're going to land safely. That's the whole thing. You just need to choose the time to land safely. And she looked at me and said, are you a pilot?
Lisa, I know you need to leave very, very soon, so thank you so much for your time.
I've got another 5 minutes, Nick, if there's anything else that you want to chat about.
Well, I did want to ask, what would be your tip to people who do have a struggle at the moment when it comes to flying? Where would you want them to begin?
Oh, well, I'd say professional help. I mean, if someone said to me they've got a broken knee, I don't tell them to go home and strap it and look after it themselves.
Yeah. Have a lie down. It should be fine.
Exactly. Yeah. So get professional help. That was the very first thing that happened for me. And stop consuming news about plane crashes. I don't even like using the word crash with a lot of instances because it's like, okay, so the wheels may not have been fully extended when it got to the runway, but, you know, everyone walked off. Everyone's okay. They all survived, you know, in whatever instant. Of course, I realise that there have been some serious ones over the last few weeks and that's why we're speaking, but a lot of the times we go to full drama straight away when in fact it's like, actually, all of the checks and balances work to ensure that even facing an extremely challenging situation, the crew were able to get this plane on the ground and everyone off. And, you know, there are more success stories than bad stories, but you don't hear about the success stories.
What has been your response to the footage coming out from Alaska Airlines?
Funny you should ask, because I've been on holidays for the last 3 weeks, but I've been still fascinated by it. And my boyfriend, funnily enough, is actually a pilot. So another irony, Nick. I know, another irony. So I'm reading all these things out to him about the details of it, and I've got to tell you, he was less than interested. Pilots just get on with the job. And, you know, he was like, okay, well, there shouldn't have just been one thing that caused that. There's got to be other things and other reasons. And they realise there are always so many more things to the story. So I was the one that was, you know, saying, listen to this. I've got another feature article on it all to read to you. I know the ironies of all of this go on. But Nick, yes. And look, funnily enough, we started this chat talking about Muster Dogs. Do you know the Muster, fabulous show that I narrate that went to air on Sunday night and broke all the ratings? It was awesome. I've got a book coming out tomorrow on Muster Dogs, and those dogs have flown so much. And Annie, who won Series 1, has done 30,000 kilometres in the air with Frank Figure.
No.
Yes, she has. And so I interviewed her vet for the book to just say, how do you prepare a dog for flying? Like, what do you do there? And it's just a fascinating thing when you have got a beautiful animal like Princess Annie, who won Series 1. How do you prep her to be heading off to shows around Australia and flying? And yes, dogs can feel anxious about flying as well, but that is a happy story because Annie loves it. Annie loves it. I love it. Everyone should love it. Get help if you're feeling a bit anxious. That's my tip.
Lisa Miller, you've been fantastic. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
No worries.
Lisa's book is about the Muster Dog series. It's out tomorrow, as she was saying. And if you haven't caught Muster Dogs, you can go to ABC iView. Season 2 is coming out at the moment. I've seen Season 1. It's beautiful. I've seen the first episode of Season 2. It's incredible. There's a lot to catch up on. Give it a go.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
My name is Nick Healy. I'm filling in for Rochelle this week. I'm in Shepparton in the Goulburn Valley region of Victoria. And today you and I are talking about a fear of flying. There's been a lot of media attention at the Alaskan Airlines flight that recently saw part of the fuselage blow out, something known as a door plug. What is it like to experience a fear of flying? How do you get past it? What do we need to be thinking about when it becomes debilitating, the way Lisa Miller was just discussing? Danny from Dalesford has actually got on the line. Danny, good morning.
Oh, hi, Nick. The whole conversation got me all goosebumps at the moment. I had a very bad fear of flying earlier days, and I've had a few flights since where I've sort of rationalised it a bit. But it all came back to me a few weeks ago when my son sent a text on his way back from Europe, travelling back with his sister and his mum, and late at night. And I got the text and it said, On the plane to Singapore now, just got to cruising height, and they've realised the door near us on the left of the plane is not sealed 100%. They're saying it should be okay, but just messaging to let you know. And he's finished off with, love you if anything happens, with a big love heart. Oh, sorry. I tell you what, it was a really tough night, because like there was messaging back and forth from me to him, just telling him it'll be all right. They're always prepared for these sorts of situations, blah, blah, blah. Then communication went down. The next morning, you know, I was panicking a bit because I hadn't heard whether they actually got to Singapore from Rome or not. And the first report I looked at was 5 killed in plane crash. And then I read further, it was the Japan incident. But you've got no idea. Until I actually heard that he was okay, it was so shocking. And I didn't get a wink of sleep all night. It was, you know, when you've got a fear of flying yourself, but you're thinking about your kids who are your dependents, it multiplies it by 1,000 times.
Danny, that's just an incredible story, and I'm glad that everyone was okay. And look, thank you for sharing. I can only vaguely imagine how emotional that would have been, having not been through that. I think that would have been, as you say, a very, very sleepless night. Look, someone else who knows a lot about a fear of flying, although coming at it from a very different angle, is Michelle Huntington, a former Virgin Australia captain, and she used to be involved in a fear of flying program for her airline. Michelle, good morning to you.
Good morning, Nick. How are you?
I'm good. We've had a few people get in touch saying that the more they learnt, the less they were afraid. When you were doing or part of that fear of flying program, what kind of work were you doing?
So what we did is we explained to passengers, people who had a fear of flying, exactly that you said. So we explained what was happening, the mechanics of the aircraft, the mechanics of weather, what turbulence was, and then putting it in layman's terms into something that they use every single day or experience every single day so that it could put their mind at ease. So, for example, the bumps that you feel with turbulence, similar to potholes in the road and jutting on the road. So it's once you put it in that sort of context, you're like, oh, okay, yeah, I put up with that all the time. So it did take a little while, and I did hear Lisa say that it took 2 years for her to get over the fear of flying, and good on her. Like, honestly, it's any fear of anything, and we know that it's an anxiety, and you do become like a negative detective. You know, you find every bit of information to support your fear and belief. So good on her for being able to change her mindset.
I think it's beautiful. We've had more than a few people texting in to say that they've been through similar courses. Anne in Elwood saying, I did a fear of flying course run by the Women's Pilots Association years ago, pre-9/11. It worked so well, we were actually able to get into a control tower and do a simulator exercise, and finishing up the course with a flight to Sydney and return. Anne saying it was the best thing ever. It must feel good knowing that you can help change people's lives that way.
Absolutely. And that was my first experience with fear of flying courses. I was a student myself, and I had heard about at Bankstown Airport and Sydney Airport, the Australian Women Pilots Association had these courses. And yeah, they were taking people up to control towers. So again, the more information that people could get, then they could understand. And that's what a lot of this fear came down to, the lack of understanding, the lack of control. So rather than, you know, getting up and flying the plane themselves, at least they knew what was happening and what to expect.
Michelle, are the crew on flights aware of who's a nervous flyer and not? I mean, do you kind of have a, without it being tagged, do you have a sense of it?
Sometimes we do get a note if there's somebody who has been quite vocal about, you know, their fear of flying, and they've contacted the airline, or they may know somebody. Otherwise, they generally tend to tell the cabin crew, and they might tell us, and we're more than happy to explain anything to them. Obviously, after 9/11, we can't allow them in the flight deck during the flight, but before and after, absolutely, if workload permits, we definitely welcome everyone in.
I love that, because my sense would be to not make a fuss. I don't want to make anyone's jobs harder. But it sounds like it's actually something people are very open to having that conversation around.
Oh, Nick, the thing about pilots is we're very happy to talk all things aircraft. So you're not really inconveniencing us at all. It's a fresh set of ears.
Michelle, can you just hang on there for a second? Because Claire from East Brighton's called in. Claire, good morning to you. Hello, Claire. Are you with us? Hello, Claire.
Hi,
how are you?
Good morning. Yeah, I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. Did you have a fear of flying yourself, did you?
I absolutely did, and I love sharing my story with whoever's prepared to listen because, like your previous guest, I was absolutely paranoid, and it was getting to a stage where my husband had an opportunity with the job to travel all the time, and every time he'd say to me, how about you join us? And I go, oh, I don't think I'm ready. Anyway, he'd had enough, and he booked me into a fear of flying course by ANSET Australia. And so I got on to the psychologist, and we went to his place, and we had a session, and he said to my husband, look, Claire's not ready to fly. So it was a bit of a process. But then I did the course at Tullamarine, and it was 6 weeks, one night a week from 6 to 9. And every night after the course, they would take us into an aircraft just to, you know, get us used to the whole idea of being in a plane. And it was the best thing I ever did, because after that, I was able to go on trips with my husband and then my children on holiday. And I'm always promoting people who do have a fear to go and do the course.
Claire, I love how successful that was for you. And it sounds like it was very gentle, sort of it was taking you at a step and at a pace that was right for you.
That's right. And so we had, you know, we had pilots present 1 week, and then we had, you know, engineers. And then one night at the end of the course, we were taken into the hangar at Tullamarine where they were putting planes together. And it was so educational and empowering that when you saw everything together, it kind of made your irrational fear more sort of, it made you more rational about flying. And so we finished up our trip with a flight to Sydney, and there were 16 of us. Well, 14 did the flight. The other two weren't ready. And funnily enough, we waited on the tarmac for about an hour. And when we got to Sydney, we went into what they call the business lounge, and then the crew told us that there was a bomb scare on the aircraft, but of course they didn't tell us that. But may I say, the crew were amazing. And so my husband, after that, he said, look, I better get you on a flight straight away before, you know, you go back to your old self. So we flew to Adelaide, and we were always told to identify ourselves. So I said to the hostess then, look, I've just done a fear of flying. And they were so lovely. And so when we were coming into a bit of turbulence, they came to me and said, now we're going to go through a little bit of turbulence. You know, you'll be fine. It's just like you're in a four-wheel drive going on a bumpy road. And then they invited me to sit in the cockpit for landing. And at first I thought, oh, I don't know if I can do this. And then I thought, you know what? This is an opportunity. Just do it. And when I landed, they gave me a bottle of champagne, and my husband sitting on the tarmac, and he said, I fly all the time, and this has never happened to me.
Never got a bottle of champagne once in his entire life, Claire. That is a fantastic story. I love success stories like that. And Michelle, while Claire was talking, saying that she had done her fear of flying course through an airline, and you were involved with one through your airline, what's the benefit for the airlines to be organising this? I mean, is there a chance that sort of someone who has an unregulated fear of flying can be disruptive? Is that the issue at play?
There could be. Look, and, you know, any problems you want to sort out on the ground before you get in the air, it doesn't make them easier up at altitude. But it's also a community service. So there, and that's how Virgin approached it, and ANSET, that it's, you know, their customers, their passengers, they want them to have the best experience possible. And the thing with customer experience is no one ever tells you about when you had a great flight, like something good happened to you. They'll tell you about when something bad happened. So if you can turn that something bad into something that exceeds their expectations, they're going to rave about you. So then guaranteed Claire thought that ANSET was amazing and, you know, went on to tell all the friends and family. And same with other customers who do any of these. Their experience, it's not only one, they don't feel like it's just them. They're not on their own, and they will tell others, and so then that airline, that company becomes, you know, better than.
Michelle, have you been seeing the footage that's been on the news lately? What's been your response as a pilot, as a former captain, to what we've seen on that 737 with Alaskan Airlines?
Look, I was interested. It's a 737. It is a MAX 9, but a bit like Lisa's boyfriend, the pilot, that I was like, oh, okay, I wonder what else has happened, because everything, there's a redundancy built in. So it's not just one hinge that holds the door on. There are, you know, many. So in case that fails, there's something else that'll hold it. And that style of door that was in the aircraft that came out, it's not even a door as such. There's no handle on it on the outside. It's not used as an exit. And it wasn't in use. But the it does look pretty spectacular. I'm interested in it, like air crash investigations. You know, I used to love that show. And however, my mum, when I was learning to fly, hated that show and was scared that, you know, something would happen to me. But I tend to, and I know other colleagues tend to look at those as exactly what has happened. And we look at the handling, and the crew did an amazing job. I did hear a media report, someone was interviewed, an influencer, that they didn't hear much from the pilots. So depressurization, they must have an oxygen mask on in the flight deck, because the pilots are pretty much the most important people on that flight at that stage. So if there's any chance of landing safely, they need to be, you know, properly oxygenated and be able to breathe. So to communicate with an oxygen mask can be tricky at times. So therefore, they'd be doing their radio calls, what were required. So a PA back to passengers would not have been a priority at that time, though they would have communicated to the cabin crew what to do.
I think that is a fascinating bit of insight there. And I'm glad you mentioned air crash investigations, because someone's texted in saying, I own the whole video series. I love them. And it's precisely because of these investigations and the response to them that air travel is so safe. And I think that's a really interesting angle on that. My takeaway from what we saw in Alaskan Airlines was the fact that everyone got down unharmed tells me how safe that travel can be when something like that can happen and people can land and be well.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, it was one of those accidents, unfortunately, lack of communication. But the, I was thinking of the Japanese, but the Alaskan Airlines, they did. And it was, I think someone lost their phone from media reports. There were a couple of phones and a little boy, his shirt was coming off. But, you know, having your seatbelt on, listening to your cabin crew, listening to all the directions definitely pays off. And, they just did an amazing job, and they did it quickly too.
Michelle Huntington, thank you so much for your time this morning. I should say Michelle also co-hosts the podcast The Captain and the Clown, talking about leadership, but she is a former Virgin Australia airline captain. Many people texting in just regarding where they've sat in terms of being afraid of flying. Stu saying, look, I'm not afraid of flying, but I am afraid of crashing. Air crash investigations actually ruined how I experience flying. But Peter, on the opposite side of it, saying, I recently got the box set of air crash investigations. They have such good explanations of what's gone wrong. For some people, it seems like that knowledge can help them get past it. And for other people, maybe a bit too much knowledge is where they feel a little bit dangerous. So where does a fear of flying come from? What can help manage it? And can we ever, I guess, be said to be fully cured of it? Now, Tamara Cavanagh is a clinical psychologist. Tamara, good morning to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm finding this fascinating because people are coming at this on so many different angles. Lisa Miller earlier saying that it was when she could take back a bit of control of flying, when she could be in a cockpit, when she could see what was happening, she felt like her fear of flying could go away. For me, it's the total lack of control that is why I'm not scared of flying. It feels like I've got no say in it, so whatever's going to happen is going to happen. So I never feel afraid when I'm flying. But I think what I want to ask you to begin with, is it a rational or an irrational fear?
Oh, I think it's a little bit of both, and it depends on what you're fearful of. Overall, if you're fearful of crashing, it's probably irrational. because of how infrequently that would occur, and your ratio and risk to threat isn't as great as perhaps you even driving in your car. So, you know, it depends what you're fearing as to whether it's rational or irrational.
And I guess that depends on the response to that fear as well. I mean, Lisa Miller saying earlier that she would get 3 days before a flight, you know, her digestion would go bad. She'd be feeling sick. She'd have muscle aches and pains. I mean, that is a debilitating reaction to fear.
Yeah, and so that's when you can almost come into rational. So is she actually fearing crashing, or in fact is she fearing the anxious feeling that she's going to have when she's on the plane? And how that's going to feel in the lead up and the few days beforehand, and then while on the flight. Because a lot of what I see is people who are fearful of the feeling they're going to have while being on the plane, not necessarily just whether it would crash.
So fearful of the actual experience of flying, not necessarily what the outcome might be. Is that what you're saying?
Pretty much. Or fearful of anxiety itself, the feeling and how yucky it is. So fear of fear.
What underpins a feeling, and I realise that it'll be a lot of individuality here, but what underpins a fear of flying?
For a lot of people, it's the fact that you're in a tight space and that you can't just exit when you want to. So if I'm feeling really anxious, or if I'm feeling like I can't handle it, I can't just leave. The doors are going to be shut and I'm going to be on that 18-hour flight or that 3 or 4 hour flight, and I'm going to have to sit there with no way of escaping this feeling. And that's probably the majority of what people fear the most.
When does it become a genuine phobia, I guess, and not sort of an anxiety? How do we clarify that or quantify that?
Yeah, so the easiest way to work out whether it's more of a problem, you know, than average is whether or not it's stopping you from doing the things that you want to do in life. So if you're going to live in Melbourne, you're not planning on leaving for anything other than a drive, and you have no, you know, real inclination to want to do so, then realistically we wouldn't call it a phobia. But if your job takes you on flights, you're going to have to fly regularly, or your family live overseas and you really want to see them. So the moment it's starting to interfere with your life is when we would kick you over into a phobia.
We're talking about a fear of flying this morning. I'd love to hear from anyone who's managed to overcome a fear of flying, what they went through. Was it a course? Was it their own work? Was it work with a professional? Tamara, if someone came to you and said, I have a fear of flying, it's awful, you know, getting on a plane is just too much for me, where would you begin with them?
So first thing I'd be working out is how often they have to fly or when they have to fly. Usually they present right before they have to. Not so helpful, so definitely getting in early. And then basically trying to work out what the point of their fear is. So for those where it's a fear of just, you know, that the plane might crash or something bad might happen while up there, then we can usually spend quite a few days going over statistics, watching planes fly off and land. You can do that both online by watching some of, you know, the programs where you've got access to what's happening at different airports, a lot of the statistics on crash rates, and a lot of thinking through the flight, and we can get over it that way. And that one is probably the easiest.
And is that sort of, you know, we're not talking sort of immersion therapy here, but obviously getting to a point where you can fly and then taking those flights safely, that's going to be a big help, not just an end result, but actually a part of getting past it, yeah?
Absolutely. So the biggest focus is making it so that you can be on the plane. You may still have some anxiety, but that you have really strong strategies to control it, manage it, and feel confident that you'll be able to do the flight. And having a lot of skills around that is what we aim to achieve.
So do people, I guess, can we ever say that we've been cured of a fear like this? Would we avoid that terminology? We would say we're managing it, or is there a way where it's just gone?
Combination of both. So, you know, you'll hear people like, I think someone said about being in the control pit and then feeling in control and no longer having the fear. If we can remove a fear, and we do this all the time, think of anything you've ever worried about, then done and now no longer fear, we absolutely have that capacity. And then on the other hand, for a lot of the really deeply embedded anxieties, you know, it can often just be that we feel like we can manage it, handle it, and get out the other side.
Tamara Cabinet, thank you so much for your time this morning. Tamara is a clinical psychologist, former president of the Australian Psychological Society, looking at how a professional would start talking about a fear of flying. We heard from Claire earlier, who called in to say she'd done a fear of flying course, had been very successful at being on planes afterwards, after it being a terrible fear for her, even to the point where once they landed, she got given by the ground crew a bottle of champagne as a congratulations. Had an anonymous text in saying, "Bottle of champagne on landing? Think I might have just developed my own fear of flying."
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
My name's Nick Healy. I'm filling in for Rochelle this week on The Conversation Hour, and we're talking about a fear of flying. I think for many people who are nervous flyers, people who do experience fear when they're up in the air, the recent saturation of video footage and photos from some of the air issues we've seen in the last couple of weeks have been very difficult to get through. How have you done it? Do you have a fear of flying? Have you managed to overcome it? What's your response been like? We've been talking a lot about how we manage to get a little bit beyond that fear, how we take ourselves, we put ourselves on planes, we find a way through. Let's just put that to the side just for a little bit. And let's say that you just can't overcome a fear of flying. Is that it for overseas travel? Are there any options? And what are they genuinely like as alternatives? Ben Groundwater is a travel writer. You'll see his work in The Age and the SMH. He also runs a number of very, very good social media accounts. Ben, good morning to you.
Hi, Nick. How are you doing?
So, Ben, let's say I can't fly and I want to go overseas, but the idea of a big, long cruise with all of the Great Gatsby parties and everything like that doesn't appeal to me. What can I do?
Look, it's difficult. Obviously, your options are very limited. But yeah, you know, there. I would point out that there are different styles of cruises. There are a lot of different cruises. You know, there are those kind of casinos of the seas that people might picture. The sort of behemoths that go around and there's lots of parties and everything. That is a thing. But you know, there are lots and lots of different styles. So there is expedition cruising that goes from Australia down to Antarctica if you really want. You know, there are place things that leave from Hobart. There are much smaller ship cruising that goes out to New Zealand or up into the Pacific Islands, where you can really choose your style of travel. But another way to get around that a lot of people don't realise is that you can actually book passenger berths on normal commercial ships as well. Merchant Navy, you know, oil tankers, container ships, whatever, commercial operations that do sometimes sell passenger berths on board, so you can get on those ships and sail basically as a normal crew member without having to do all the work. It's certainly not glamorous, but it will get you from A to B and get you to another country if you have a bit of time on your hands.
Ben, two things. One, apologies. Did not mean to malign the entire cruise industry. That's very rude of me, and I'm sorry. And I've been on a very short cruise myself that was actually just a food and wine cruise. I'm pretty sure I was back in Sydney, drove out beyond the heads and just did laps for 3 days while we ate and drank. It was very, very lovely, by the way. But I've never heard that you can book a berth on, like, a regular boat before. I mean, how have we not heard about this? Is it one of the great travel secrets?
Oh, look, I mean, I guess it only appeals to a very niche market of people, really. These are people, as I said, you've got to have a lot of time on your hands. You're looking at weeks or months to get to your destination and then come back again in the same amount of time. You're staying in pretty unglamorous quarters. You know, these vessels are not set up for tourism operations or anything. So you're just sleeping in a normal room, probably in a bunk bed. You're just eating the food that everybody else on board eats. There's nothing fancy about it at all. But, you know, I've got a family history of merchant navy shipping. And so it kind of appeals to me in that sort of a romantic sense to kind of dive back into what my dad and my grandfather and my great-grandfather did. And so, you know, people who are sort of into shipping and that sort of thing would be interested in it. People who obviously have a fear of flying and need to get around the world might be interested in it as well. But yeah, as a kind of tourism experience, it's quite a difficult sell to a lot of people, which I can completely understand.
Ben, I think you and I are on the same page. It sounds very romantic to me. I imagine myself in a big thick jumper standing on the prow looking, you know, glowering at the sea. Have you done it?
I haven't. No, I just don't have the time. I can never sort of scrape together, you know, a couple of months in order to get across the world. Like I said, and you said that it is quite a romantic idea and quite a nice idea. Picture yourself in a Hemingway-style jumper, standing on the bridge, staring out at the horizon. But yeah, I've just never been able to find time to do that. So maybe one day I would really love to. And the idea of cutting down on flying, even for someone who's not afraid of the experience, it has a lot of appeal because, you know, we should all be trying to fly less. So, you know, maybe that's a thing that I'll be able to do one time.
Well, very much so. And a few people have texted in to saying, look, it's not a bad deal if people fly less. It's quite good for the environment. And, of course, it should be noted that if you're in Europe and a large amount of America, I mean, train travel is very well regarded and very viable.
Absolutely, yeah. That's kind of what I would say to people who do have a fear of flying but want to travel internationally. If you can get yourself through one flight or two flights, I would be looking at destinations that have really impressive and extensive rail networks. And so obviously Europe is one of those. Once you touch down in any European destination, you know, you can still buy those old Eurail passes where you can travel by train for, you know, a week or a month or in unlimited ways. So that's a really great way to see a lot of the world. Or, you know, somewhere like Japan obviously is amazing. China is getting much, much better with high-speed rail as well. These are places where you can see a vast amount of destinations just by not, you know, having to fly at all. If you can get yourself through that initial journey to get there, which, you know, maybe you'll do by ship, who knows?
Ben, if I can hang on to you for 2 seconds, Norm from Geelong's on the line. Norm, good morning to you.
Good morning. I loved what you said before when you said that, you know, it's kind of out of your control and therefore if you're going to fly, you just have to accept it. I've never really had a fear of flying, but something happened to me in 2016. I was involved in a, you know, significant situation that made headlines, certainly around Australia and also around the world, where basically we're up in a plane and going from Singapore to Europe, and the engine went terribly wrong. We had to turn around on one engine, and then as we landed, the entire engine blew up and engulfed the side of the plane with flames, and we're on the news. Anyway, the point is, I never really had a fear of it, but I had to give some statements about different things. And basically how it affected me is the airline was the best airline, the plane was the best plane, and the captain was a 30-year pilot. And all three things made mistakes to lead towards that situation happening. And so it made me realise that, you know what, if it's going to go wrong, it's going to go wrong. And there's not much mitigation. So for me, now when I get on a plane, I just accept the fact, okay, I'm going to get on a plane and it's out of my hands, you know. So either I have to just accept what's going to happen or I don't get on the plane. Now, so, I used to travel a lot back then. I travel less now. But every time I get on a plane, I just think, okay, I know what can go wrong. I kind of feel like it's my defence now. Do you know what I mean?
You've been on something that's gone wrong, so therefore you're likely to be okay?
Maybe. I know that's not how statistics or random, but I got to tell myself that anyway.
Norm, absolutely incredible story, and thank you so much for sharing that. Ben, you travel so much. Has it ever put you on the back foot? Have you ever had a period where you didn't feel comfortable on that travel, on that flight?
Not really a period where I've worried about it more. I think, actually, to be honest, since having kids, I've got two young kids who are 5 and 3. Since having them, I wouldn't say a fear of flying, but there's certainly more nervousness every time I buckle myself in and I just think to myself, like, there's so much riding on this. I have to get home. I have to be safe. This has to be okay. And so that's, I suppose, a little bit more of a worry. There was one particular flight. I did a flight to French Polynesia from Australia, and they typically go at night. And so, and apparently I've since heard that they typically experience a lot of turbulence as well. So that was a flight where it was pitch dark over the Pacific, and there was a lot of turbulence, and I was scared then, and I tend not to worry too much about turbulence, but when you can't see the horizon, you know, it's all dark, you're not really sure how high up you are or anything, and you're over this vast expanse of ocean, that's when I think all those kind of natural fears start to kick in. So that for me was the one where I was really, really worried about it at the time. But yeah, mostly I tend not to be too concerned. I try to think about, you know, which your psychologist was talking about, think about the statistics and think about the realities and the fact that you are so high up and that any sort of turbulence and everything can be weathered and sorted out far before there's any real problem. So, you know, you try to go through all those practicalities in your brain and switch off that fear, which is not always easy, but I do tend to manage it most of the time.
Ben, I'm going to rudely put you on hold again. We'll have a quick chat to Jack, who's called in. Jack, how are you this morning?
I've been a very frequent international traveller, and I've had some fairly interesting experiences, if we can call it that. And one of the things that I will do now is that I look at what the flight attendants, how the flight attendants are reacting to the situation. And invariably, they're calm and they sit back and have a bit of a chat, and that actually calms me down. So that gives me a sense that everything's under control. However, if that wasn't the case and they looked rather anxious, then I'm probably going to be quite anxious as well.
Right. So you look to the professionals and gauge their response.
Indeed.
Jack, thanks so much for calling in. And Ben, in all of your flights, all of your travel, you've seen the full gamut, I imagine, of professionality. You feel safe when you fly, don't you?
I do, yeah. And I think that's a really great idea, actually, to look at the flight attendants and as a way to help you calm yourself down. I do that a lot without even realising that it's the sort of thing that I would have to do. I've never seen flight attendants look flustered or look panicked. And so I suppose that's very good fortune on my part. It means that everything has been safe. And if they were starting to look worried, then I would be genuinely concerned. But before that, you can kind of, it makes you realize, okay, this is routine. This is a normal thing that happens, and there's really nothing to fear. So that's great advice. I think I would definitely take that.
Ben, I'll let you go. You're off to Japan soon, aren't you?
I am, yeah. I'm actually, before that, I'm flying to South America. I'm going to Antarctica in a few weeks' time. Oh. So long flight right over the Pacific, but yeah, hopefully it all goes well.
Ben Groundwater, thank you so much. Ben is a travel writer. You can get his work through The Age, the SMH. As I said before, if you go and have a bit of a hunt for his social media, it's always incredible the places he goes to and the experiences he's willing to share. And thank you to everyone who has been sharing their incredible experiences. Some remarkable tales of people getting beyond the fear of flying and managing to move on. A lot of people finding just a lot of comfort in looking at how professional and how well-maintained so many of our airlines are. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about changing jobs later in life. Is it something you've done? What made you want to change that job? How difficult was it? We're going to look at where I think some of the stumbling blocks are for people who want to make that midlife or later life career change. That's all for today. Thanks for your company. I look forward to speaking with you tomorrow.